This is CliffCentral.com.
The one story that I suppose everybody has been focused on this year is this. It seems like a pitched battle between the finance minister and the presidency. And into this battle are drawn various sides, various parties. We've got Pravin Gordhan and a bunch of people who support Mqobisi Jonas and some other people in there. We have on the other side the supposedly the president, although he says he's not involved in this at all, Sean Abrahams. We've got SARS's Tom Moyani. We had a very embarrassing incident last week where someone revealed that they were kidnapped effectively. They were held hostage in a boardroom and forced to sign affidavits, which has led to a lot of embarrassing disclosures. And it seemed to me like people are losing their minds in all of this contestation and this confusion. And this morning, it is entirely appropriate that we have the authors of a new book, which is called Rogue. That was the name the unit was given. Some say in error, some say unfairly. SARS's Rogue Unit. The two authors of this book, Johan van Nochrenberg and Adrian Lakay, are with us today. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you? Are you in good spirits? Is there a reason to be in good spirits this morning? How are you, Adrian? How's it?
Good morning, guys.
Nice to see you guys.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to have us on this program.
No, sure. What a pleasure. Johan, I saw you were looking pretty tired. You were sitting in that sofa out there. Are you exhausted by all of this?
Yes. Good morning, Gareth. Very.
I don't blame you. You guys were very high-level SARS employees. You worked in undoubtedly the most effective and efficient government department in South Africa. SARS has always been held up as a kind of a paragon of what could be achieved in the bureaucracy. And SARS have had a sterling record of bringing in money to the fiscus, helping South Africa to do a whole lot of good work. And I don't think very many people would question the efficacy and the professionalism with which many people in SARS do their job. Certainly not the kind of work that you guys were doing in there before. But there was this story that's developed over the last 5 or 6 years that's really upset a lot of people. And it hasn't just cost you your jobs. It hasn't just cost people like Ivan Pillay his job. It's also now put the finance minister in a very precarious position. Not just this, but an accumulation of things. And it's created a complete pitched battle between Treasury and the rest of government in some way, shape, or form. That's an ugly and unwieldy summary of the problem. But in your book, you go into it in a lot more detail. So if you went back 5 years ago to the establishment of this unit, I think originally there were, 20-something people in it, right? What was the purpose then, and how was that perverted in the media through the course of those 5 years to the point that we now have to have something that we would never have conceived of before? Two guys who were inside SARS telling us the story of what went wrong in such a public way, in such a blockbuster book. How did it happen? Can you cast your mind back, Johan?
Yes, Gareth. Well, thinking back to those days when the unit came about, it was actually a concept that was determined in conjunction between various government agencies, the then National Intelligence Agency, mm-hmm. and the South African Revenue Service. That was the original idea, and the idea was to seek ways to utilize those powers that existed within the Revenue Service Agency to assist other law enforcement agencies to combat crime.
So was it established by one or two ministers in conjunction? Would you have the finance minister and the then intelligence minister?
Look, I don't have the details because I personally wasn't involved at the time. But
right.
from my research and my understanding is that it was discussed at a very high level.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, my things has gone dead.
But oh, you don't need them. You can take it off, actually.
Okay.
Just relax.
So it was discussed, and it was discussed at senior levels within the government departments. But that idea never saw fruition.
Mm-hmm.
It never concluded. But what did happen was that the Revenue Service Agency did go ahead and started honoring its side of that bargain. And found itself left in the lurch. by the other agency, and was stuck with this unit of 26 people at that point in time, and then had to do something with them. And they were then converted into a fully fledged, complete SASH unit with a revenue service and customs mandate.
And they were obviously going to go after targets in organized crime, I suppose, in activities that there was blatant or less direct evasion of tax responsibilities. The job of this unit was to find money that SARS was owed by sometimes very high profile people.
Yes, I would perhaps say slightly different, that they were created to conduct those investigations that presented a danger to the conventional revenue service auditors and investigators. And their primary focus was organized crime. And virtually from day one, they started showing tremendous successes. I mean, from the point when they started, which was March 2007, a month later, they had participated in the biggest bust of illegal abalone in KwaZulu-Natal. I think it was 6.5 tons of illegal abalone, which is a lot.
Millions of rands worth, yeah.
So, absolutely. The focus was always organized crime.
Now, Adrian, I remember we spoke to you all those years ago when you were the spokesperson then for SARS. And this never came up. This wasn't a much discussed unit. There were other things that were more important, and SARS was, as I said earlier, the most efficient government department. It seemed that everything was well run and operated. There seemed to be a lot of very competent people in place in SARS. And at that stage, Pravin Gordhan was still the commissioner all those years ago. You didn't have a lot to do as the spokesperson because there wasn't a lot of controversy. Or am I being glib?
Yeah. Look, I think many of us were very proud to have worked for SARS. We were proud about the institution and the small role it could play to advance the developmental potential of our country and to safeguard our economy and to finance the fiscus. Those were good years when our economy was growing beyond 3% and even touching on 4% until 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the people of this country realized that as part of their social contract in this democracy, tax is important. They have a legal obligation if they want this democracy to function properly and enjoy the rights afforded to all of us by the Constitution. So all of us were very proud of being able to work for this prestigious public sector institution called SARS.
Mm.
And if you measure that with the absolute horrific scandal that plagues this institution as recently as last week,
mm-hmm.
where a commissioner would send in his bodyguard to basically act as a bouncer against an official who's worked for SARS as a legal expert for more than 30 years, to forcefully, with officials from the Hawks, allegedly remove documents that he, in their view, were not entitled to have in his possession,
mm-hmm.
that was given to him by the SARS commissioner, the harassment, the intimidation, even to the extent of alleged physical harm, is absolutely scandalous. And I think under Tom Moyane, since his appointment in October 2014, the reputation of the institution has suffered and continues to suffer. And the point that we've made in whatever public forums we've addressed on this book is that it is absolutely untenable in a democracy like ours, where a SARS commissioner, who is supposed to report to a minister of finance,
mm-hmm.
is actually the complainant in a criminal investigation by the Hawks against that minister.
And whether the Hawks and this commissioner have been talking counter and contrary to the points that they wish the public to know about. It's almost as if there's a public and a private face of SARS.
Correct. I think it is absolutely disgraceful. And the long-term consequences for the institution worries me. We saw in last week's medium-term budget that revenue estimations for this year is something like 15 to 20 billion under the target that was announced in February. Our economy is not growing. We'll be lucky if we grow at 1% our GDP this year. That means revenue will not flow in to be able to meet our fiscal targets. That means in a constrained environment like this, you need a revenue agency that knows its work, that is focused on delivering the revenue the fiscus needs,
mm-hmm.
and a commissioner who is not embroiled in one scandal after the next, week after week, all in pursuit of the Minister of Finance to have him in court and to have him charged criminally. I think that is absolutely disgraceful, Gareth.
You're not holding back. You come out with all guns blazing right at the start, Adrian. I barely opened the doors and you're charging through them. Okay, let's just, for a minute, let's just talk about what this means for the credibility of SARS. Because if your revenue service isn't credible, or if it seems that it is acting against itself or the interests of the state, you could have a situation where people see it as a gap to start evading and confusing certain gray areas in their taxes. This could represent a much bigger problem for the confidence that people have in SARS. I mean, when you guys worked for SARS, it must be quite a thing to go out and people find out you work for SARS. Their whole attitude to you changes. I mean, whether they're rich or poor, nobody really loves the tax man, but there's a quiet respect for it. And I think when SARS send you communications, people take that very seriously. People consider that to be something of paramount importance. They dedicate a lot of time and energy and money into making sure that they abide by the quite strict tax regulations that we have. And there are very clear rules, and there are auditors, and there are all kinds of people that ordinary private citizens have in their employ in order to make sure that they comply with SARS. Now if you have this, where things are being questioned at an ethical level, it tends to erode the credibility of the entire institution.
And the public trust, Gareth, the public trust, importantly. And that took years to build and establish. Now, we're now on 31 October. The tax season deadline is the end of November. And ordinarily, when we worked for the institution, this would be the last 3-4 weeks where we would really focus all the attention amongst our 14 or 15,000 staff across the country
mm-hmm.
to make sure people are aware there's a deadline, submit your tax return. If you need help, come and talk to us. If we can avail help to big corporates and send our people to your office to help your employees, we would be on talk shows, we would take calls, we would mm-hmm. answer questions from the public, because that was the public trust that we tried to establish and build upon. Now, you ask yourself when last any of those things happened, when people were availed themselves to come and say to taxpayers, we're ready to talk to you, we're ready to help you. That was the essence of our tax season campaign every year. Not leading up to Wednesday, where your minister must appear in court to face frivolous, in my view, criminal charges related to this rogue unit. And that is really the sad part, which may also be a long-term consequence if the public trust in the institution is completely eroded.
Johan, you were a very important man in SARS.
I never believed that.
No, well, I'll say it because you don't have to. But you led investigations against Billy Rotenbach, Ivan Korza, Julius Malema, Lolly Jackson, Glenn Agliotti, Radovan Krecher. These are all very, very well-known people, even to South Africans who don't necessarily know the inner workings of SARS.
Hmm.
You also had quite wide-ranging responsibilities within the organization, but you must have worked with Pravin Gordhan when he was commissioner.
I did, yes.
And your estimation of, I mean, the thing that they dig up about him, that he supposedly has committed all kinds of evil around, is a retirement package.
Well, you see, Gareth,
is this all they could find?
Well, the two of you, Adrian and you, are too quick for me. I'm much slower. I want to take you back to December 2009.
Okay.
In December 2009, Mr. Julius Malema drew attention to this unit first by releasing a document to the media which was called the Picha dossier. Yeah. And it also went by the name of Operation Snowman.
Uh-huh.
This was a document that was compiled by a former member of this particular unit who had been dismissed in early 2009 for his involvement in illegal poaching of rhino. He then compiled a document together with a few other people and released this document. And at that point in time, up until February 2010, the Revenue Service was quite capable of refuting the allegations being made by Mr. Picha at that time. In fact, lots of documents were released to the media. We invited the South African police and the State Security Agency to come and investigate this unit, and we never received any feedback from them. So it's not quite correct that, you know, the first time people heard of this unit was in 2014.
Right.
It dates back to then. But we were able to show that the unit was a SARS unit. It did proper SARS work, and, you know, this was its mandate, and this was the work that it did.
And there was no overreach at that point that anyone could point fingers at.
No. And then some years went by, and it was only in October 2014, I think 2 weeks after Mr. Moyane started at the Revenue Service, that the very first article pinned onto this unit was published in the Sunday Times under the headline, SARS Bugged Zuma. And then from there on, and this is my point, from there on, 39, I counted them, and I can recall each and every headline for you. But from there on, the public was told that this unit broke into homes, planted listening devices in the president's house, ran a secret slush fund of over 500 million rand, intercepted taxpayers' communications, and so forth.
Was involved in the illegal cigarettes. And
yes,
all that.
I mean, it was just...
Importantly, ran a brothel.
Yes, you ran a brothel.
Ran
as well.
A brothel, and it was just this persistent media campaign that ultimately, you know, sought to inform the public of how rogue this unit really was. And none of us who were involved in managing the unit were allowed to defend ourselves publicly. In fact, we were told we're not allowed to engage the media. So there was this one-sided story that, you know, was being sold off.
It was driven mostly by the Sunday Times.
Absolutely, yeah. And then came these sort of quasi-panels, which were used to bolster this narrative.
Mm-hmm.
One was the Sikakane panel, and later came a panel chaired by retired Judge Kruen, followed by an investigation by KPMG. Except none of these panels sought to hear us.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't afford us an opportunity to answer questions, and they didn't afford us an opportunity to see their findings and respond to those findings.
Can I just ask
so,
you before
so
you...
So that's the route we've come. So from all 39 articles, we're now down to what sounds to me like three or four things. How the unit was established.
Yeah.
There's some story about fake ID cards. Okay. By the way, those were SARS cards, so... Whatever they presented themselves with to whomever, they'd still have to say they worked for SARS. But I explained the story of the cards. There was
the
a
book,
misunderstanding.
Yeah. And
something,
the third thing?
Something three or four people did or didn't do on Sunday evenings way back in 2007, which is connected to the NPA and the Scorpions, the erstwhile Scorpions, and then this pension issue. So
right.
It's boiled down to those four things now, it seems.
So in other words, in all of that noise, there's very little that actually could be presented as truth. My point is, and this is the question I wanted to ask you, was the Sunday Times really just being used by a coordinated group of people who had a disinformation agenda? And are the Sunday Times so stupid that they just published this stuff on the basis of an informant, or many informants, depending on the situation, without ever actually doing any of the homework around how much of it was true? Or was it much more sinister? Is there something going on where someone was trying to deliberately misinform the public, and the Sunday Times was only the vehicle for that?
Gareth, I prefer to stick to fact.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is speculative.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want
there.
To speculate.
He's perfect for SARS, hey, Mubs? Doesn't like to speculate. Sticks to the fact.
But I will say this. I think the journalists who were part of these stories are all very experienced, acclaimed journalists. They've been in the field for many, many years. They've all won awards for their investigative journalism. They respect a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if a person comes to you and tells you this unit ran a brothel, I would imagine that an investigative journalist will say, okay, boys, where's this brothel?
Let's go check it out.
Let's go check it out. We stake it out. We see who the clients. We get evidence. They didn't do that. The same with the SARS-bugged Zuma. The same with the millions in funding. And so I can go on. So, you know, I have to question the diligence that was applied in this particular instance.
All right. Now, Adrian, let's talk some more about these very high-profile cases. You know, you've already mentioned that the Rogue Unit was first described as being an entity by Julius Malema. But you've obviously had quite a lot to do with Radovan Krecher and Lolly Jackson and all of these people. I mean, these are some dangerous people. These are some very... maybe you're better to answer this, Johan. I mean, you were actually the guy who spearheaded this stuff. When you're investigating someone like Radovan Krecher, where do you even start? Because these people don't leave a trail. A lot of the business is cash. It's very hard to figure out where the criminal activity is taking place. And obviously, you're trained professionals. If I'm, as an ordinary member of the public, to understand the nature of your work, where do you begin in situations like this?
All right. So I think what must be borne in mind is that this unit did not operate in isolation. I managed five units, of which this was 5% of my day task, if that much. Each of the different units that I managed at the time had different specialities and different capabilities. So there would have been criminal investigators, your audit type, you had this specialized unit that looked at organized crime. We had former commercial crime investigators and a combination, a pool of resources. And I tell the story in the book of, you know, we'd start from scratch. We'd literally start with a blank slate on a whiteboard in my office and begin to see what do we know. And typically, you start looking at what's in the media, what's been reported on. You reach out to your former colleagues, my former colleagues in the law enforcement agencies, and see what they're prepared to give you. And slowly but surely, you begin to build a sort of a profile around the particular subject you're looking at and his or her associates. You then typically would begin to look at what's available on open databases. Vehicle registrations, company registrations,
Facebook,
and so forth, Facebook, etc. Yeah.
You guys get to see, Mubs, this is the interesting stuff. This is what, you do cover some of this in the book, but for ordinary us, we're always intrigued and curious about how it is that SARS gets their information. Because, you know, we see our next door neighbor driving a very, very expensive car, but they say they work at a meat packing process plant. And you kind of get you get a little bit curious yourself. How does SARS find out that this is someone worth investigating? You know what I mean, Mubs?
Well, we're definitely intrigued because a lot of the time we only see that kind of stuff being revealed in movies. But then you think to yourself, I wondered like all the different ways in which SARS have tracked down money through nefarious activities and the lengths that people go to.
And they do that. You do check social media.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the Krecher case is a good case in point. But I mean, it sounds a lot more, what's the word?
James Bond.
Than what it really is. It's slog work.
I mean, a lot of it is balance sheets and trying to figure out cash flow and very boring.
That comes much later. Stuff. You know, at first you just begin to attend court cases where these people go to court. You see who they meet, what cars they get into, you get the registration number, you check what companies are perhaps registered to or linked to that company.
Do you have carte blanche in SARS? I mean, you can't break the law, but do you have a lot of scope to do investigation of this kind? I mean, people imagine that your resources are unlimited.
No, in fact, you'd be surprised. I think the enforcement capacity of the Revenue Service has always been very tiny in comparison to the balance of the operational part of SARS, which you deal with on a daily basis when you file your returns. But we had a strategy, which I explain in the book too. You know, we tried to be all over the country. We tried to punch above our weight. We tried to focus on all tax types, all taxpayer types, and we really try to help law enforcement in general to focus on what they consider to be their high priority subjects in the criminal sphere of our society. And carte blanche, no, you always operate within the law. This unit has always operated within the law. I maintain that, and I will maintain that throughout. To access things, some things are, you don't require powers to access, like Facebook. I mean, that's open for the world to see.
Right.
Or your Twitter account, or whatever the case might be. Yeah. In some instances, when you, for instance, have to go to a bank, and you ask for bank statements of a particular company, then you are required to do some paperwork and, you know, invoke a certain particular power that you want to use, depending on what outcome you seek. If you want to seek a criminal prosecution, you'd have to use a certain set of laws. If you want to achieve a civil tax outcome, you'd have to use tax laws. If it's customs related or excise related, you'd have to use those powers.
Does SARS always let you know if they're busy looking at you, or is it okay for them to do all this stuff without letting you know? Like, they're not going to call up Radovan and say to him, hey, by the way, we're checking out your finances. We're looking into your tax affairs.
No, this is the interesting thing, and I've always maintained that the advantage of a tax investigation or a customs investigation above the typical investigations being conducted by the police, for instance,
yes,
is that you get the opportunity to engage your subject from day one.
Uh-huh.
So the very first step always would be you send off a letter to notify the person that we are now going to conduct an audit of your financial affairs. Please give us the following. And, you know, inevitably some do, and those who have things to hide don't. And then you begin to dig.
Right.
So you've always got that advantage from a tax perspective of constant engagement. And that's what makes this whole allegation of this unit supposedly conducting lifestyle audits of senior politicians so ludicrous. Because a lifestyle audit, by its very nature, requires a letter with a questionnaire to be sent to that particular person. So, you know, a journalist could have just gone to any one of those politicians and said, well, did you receive a lifestyle questionnaire from this unit?
How often do lifestyle audits get carried out? I mean, is this a fairly regular process in SARS? Is it something that during your time there you used to do often?
Look, it's but one tool in the audit toolbox. And that typically comes into play when you start looking at finances that are off radar. So it's a tool that's fairly commonly used. It's perhaps the label is overly used or too pronounced sometimes in society. It's just one other means to, you know, ask the taxpayer to say, look, tell me how your assets have grown over the last 5 years. Tell me what bank accounts you have. Do you have Kruger Rands? Where do you have shares? And, you know, it's a standard questionnaire that you can probably get on the internet.
Right.
I think also, just to touch on a few points that was under discussion now, the most successful cases, and we touch on some of them in the book, for example, the Dave King matter.
Yeah. Massive case.
It's where there was good collaboration between various law enforcement agencies, because everyone may have a different mandate. So if you have the South African Reserve Bank, the Financial Intelligence Center, the NPA, the Asset Forfeiture Unit, and SARS were the police. And in that particular matter, which was one of the biggest, I mean, and most complex, is what we argue in the book, tax litigations before court, that certainly we were aware of or involved in, various elements in those law enforcement agencies, if it comes together, it works very well. So you had the NPA prosecuting criminal charges against the individual. You had the Asset Forfeiture Unit with collaboration of SARS going to their counterparts in the UK, the Serious Fraud Office, getting a worldwide preservation order on assets, billions and billions of assets, so that it can be preserved. So that whenever a criminal trial is concluded before court in South Africa, there's an asset base to recover monies from.
Internationally.
Correct. The Reserve Bank, and that was one of the first I think, international legal cooperation of this kind, where a court in the UK finds that all your assets anywhere in the world is under preservation. Similarly, the Reserve Bank looked at foreign exchange control violations. There was a penalty there. And so that case endured before court for more than a decade against the individual, Mr. King, and various of his companies, until it was settled before court. So it proves the success if law enforcement can work in a bona fide manner, without malice, follow the law, and execute their mandates. And I think this this one case is probably the high mark of how successful the state can be.
I can just add, I mean, we were always a learning organization from day one. So some of the cases you've mentioned, we built up on what we the knowledge and experience we acquired from
many smaller cases, yeah.
And you know, ultimately, some of these cases influenced how the tax laws were amended. You know, for many years we had to rely on, the Revenue Service had to rely on asset forfeiture legislation to preserve assets.
Mm-hmm.
It's now no longer required. The Revenue Service can do so on its own. It hasn't done that lately, but you know, it's there in law. And so we've always, I think that's something that Minister Gordon and Mr. Pillay and others certainly instilled in our minds, was that one was that we were continued activists to take the struggle for economic emancipation of the country forward, and as Revenue Service officials we were best placed to do so. And the second thing was, you don't know it all. We're learning. We're learning as we go.
You must have seen some very curious ways for people to hide money. I mean, there must have been complicated things built. Because if someone has lots and lots of money and they've acquired it in dirty ways, they probably are employing some very smart people to help them hide it. What are some of the most creative ways you've seen people trying to hide their money?
Well, there's someone called the gentleman, Mr. Jonas Makwakwa, who's now on suspension.
This is the deputy commissioner.
Well, he was pretty much number two in the institution.
Right.
And allegedly, according to news reports and a report by the Financial Intelligence Center, there were large amounts of cash deposited into their bank accounts at ATMs and so on for the greater part of 2014, 2013 and so on, totaling some 1.2 million. And this is for an individual who earns a normal salary as a public servant to be in possession of such amounts of cash. At some point, suspicions must be raised. That's one method. I think more creative and more skilled people have different ways of concealing income or disclosing as little as they can of income.
Look, I've seen it all. I'm sure I can tell you.
Like, in people's safes at home. I mean, what kind of things have you seen?
I'll give you some examples.
This is fascinating.
I recall in the early 2000s being part of a team that conducted a search and seizure at a clearing agent's home. And beneath the stairs was a sort of a door. I have something similar to that, but and it fits my washing machine and dryer.
Okay.
It's that sort of thing, you know, that's underneath the stairs. And as we pulled open the door, cash fell out of that thing. It was stacked it was literally stacked up to the top. Stuffed in there. Okay, so that's like the most blatant example of
not very clever, okay.
I've also seen, if you want to look at more creative ways, I also saw an instance where somebody took their cash, which they, you know, their illegal proceeds, and purchased pay-as-you-go vouchers.
For phones, yeah?
And they would then resell that at a slight discount. So, you know, what this guy had was he had thousands and thousands and millions worth of airtime,
yeah,
which he, as and when he needed money, he would sell off his airtime at a slight discount to somebody else. The more sophisticated ones would have been probably, in my view, where we managed to get the preservation order to apply in the British Virgin Isles and Guernsey, which was a first for South Africa. I mean, we made history there. You know, we poked through the the veil of secrecy of some of these
tax havens.
Yeah.
I would be curious though, in the year 2016, most money is actually digital. It isn't cash. It isn't gold bars. It isn't the kind of wealth that pirates would have found on a treasure island. And therefore, it's not as glamorous or exciting to discover these loopholes or these creative ways that people have managed to electronically hide money. But the amounts are much bigger. And I would imagine that you probably have had to come up with very technological answers to some SARS questions in your time that you were there.
Absolutely.
You must have used the services of IT professionals, hackers, these kind of people who really are the brains in bank robbery. It's not going in with a gun.
I can tell you, we were definitely beginning to look at e-currency in the various forms that they exist worldwide. I wouldn't want to tarnish any particular one because it's not the brand that's bad. It's how people use these things. There was another project that we had started, and coincidentally, this particular unit was involved with it just before it was shut down, and that was to look at internet casinos, where people deposit money, and it's sort of cyber money. It stays there. These casinos are not registered in South Africa. The domains are out there in the ether. And we really began to sort of get a handle onto how people had cottoned onto either depositing money at casinos on most valued cards and keeping it there,
yeah,
and only withdrawing it when they use it. And then the use of these internet casinos. So, yeah, we had some pretty smart guys, and they've all left, by the way, sadly.
Yeah, I mean, this is the point, Adrian, is that SARS now is probably not as efficient, and we can see in the kind of money that they're able to recover in terms of taxes. It's not the efficient machine that it once was, the pride of government departments, right?
I don't know, Gareth. I would like to believe the opposite, but we'll see in time. But that's the real danger and the sadness of this whole saga. Where we begin the book is in March 2016, this year, where we refer to a written answer by the Minister of Finance to a question in Parliament asking about the exodus or the loss of skills at the institution since Moyane joined, which is around about end of September, beginning October 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And over that 19-month period until March 2016, 55 senior managers have left, including ourselves. These were people at Johan's level, group executives, chief officers who served on the SARS Exco, the chief operating officer, Barry Hoare, left, Ivan Pillay, the deputy commissioner, left, and in one way or the other, all of their resignations had to do with this rogue unit thing that played itself out in the media and that caused so much damage to the institution, to the careers, and to the lives of people. And if I can just refer to Mr. Barry Hoare, he joined SARS in 2005. Mm-hmm. He came to us from Nedco. He headed up our operations, and by 2007, we were able to extend e-filing to all businesses and individual taxpayers. And from that time, I remember very well, it was announced by Minister Trevor Manuel and Mr. Gordon, who was still the commissioner. From that time, SARS intensely invested in building its operations and IT capability, because the only way you can keep up with modern trends of money exchange, money flows, and income earned or concealed is if your own systems are able to speak to the best systems in financial services, right, in insurance. By the time we left, we were able to, most working people have a vehicle allowance or a car allowance from the employer. You then buy a vehicle on hire purchase or whatever the conditions may be. But we were able to engage car dealerships to see that on this day, Gareth buys this vehicle. It must be serviced more or less once a year. The mileage that you declare on your tax return, is it consistent with your dealership's records? For example, your retirement annuities, what your employer deducts, is it consistent with what you declare to Liberty, for example, or the taxes you would claim against your contributions.
So you're not keeping two sets of books or lying to one party.
And the automation and the modernization journey really, it cost a lot of money, but it built systems that were able to interact with the best in financial services and that could give you an instantaneous outcome almost of your tax return when you submitted online. So that was a journey. Now, by March 2016, most of those people have gone. Barry Orr now heads up the new bank that Discovery wants to start and had provisional approval for from the Register of Banks last year. Skills have left the institution, which, and the institutional memory that many people commanded in those positions. And to replace that will be very difficult.
Here's a personal question for both of you, because I do want to, this book is a break from tradition. Usually people who occupied positions like you two did, you would go into retirement eventually when you decided you'd had enough, or that the institution decided they'd had enough of you. But either way, you'd part amicably. And what was done in SARS was not spoken of outside of SARS. You've broken with that tradition. But Ingrid wants to know, is there anything personally for the two of you in this whole saga that you regret?
If I can just start with the first part of your question. If you look at Johan van Lochrenberg, Ivan Pillay, even Praveen left Mr. Gordon, sorry, to become a minister, Pete Richer and others. They all resigned and parted ways with SARS. Some of them settled, they went off into the sun, and the sunset. Mm. And if you can compare this to, for example, Anwar Dramat at the Hawks, you say, okay, these headlines are adverse to the institution and to me. Let's part ways. Is a new minister or a new commissioner? We don't see eye to eye. Let's move. So they go. They leave the institutions. What happens? Less than a month after Ivan Pillay and Pete Richer resigns from SARS, together with Van Lochrenberg, criminal charges are brought against him with the Hawks.
Right.
Anwar Dramat settles early 2015. He's still facing criminal charges today regarding the illegal renditions in quotations of Zimbabwe nationals. Mm-hmm. So it's as if state institutions, SARS under Muyane, the Hawks under Ntlemeza, the Minister of Police, they don't only want to get you out of the institutions. You must be hounded out. Your reputation is completely destroyed through a persistent campaign in the media. And ultimately, you will face criminal charges. You will not be able to restore your reputation, find work anywhere in this country. You have to answer to a court of law whether that docket or the criminal proceedings are without any legal basis, as I'm sure we will see towards the rest of
Praveen Gordon as well.
Week against the minister.
Yeah, how does that make you feel? I mean, it just seems to me, Johan, like, you know, you did the gentlemanly thing. You decided I'm going to get out of here. I can't do this anymore. It doesn't feel right to me. And then you also get this sort of Damocles hanging over you.
Yeah. Look, I say bring it on. My conscience is clear, and, you know, I think people who bother to read the book will understand why I say so. Regrets. You know, it's a hindsight is a perfect science.
Sure.
But if I have to say what I do regret, it would be three things. One is certainly that short-lived and very damaging relationship that I got involved in. I absolutely regret that, because that was the initial trigger and pretext for what followed.
Just explain to anybody who hasn't read the book what you mean.
Well, in September 2013, I met a lawyer in the course of my duties at the Revenue Service. She later, some months later, asked me out on a date. We were both single.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, formed a romantic relationship. And as the relationship progressed, I came to discover more and more things about this lady that made me feel incredibly uncomfortable, to the point where in early May, I ended the relationship. Towards the end of May, she, in response to me warning her that the media was going to conduct inquiries on our relationship, caused an email to be sent to a whole lot of managers at the Revenue Service. And that caused the very first panel to investigate me. At that point in time, there was no mention of the unit, by the way. It was just all about me.
Doesn't this seem so unfair, Mavs? I mean, who doesn't have a relationship? I mean, who on earth is meant to live in an inert singlehood forever?
But you know, it's like a bad divorce.
Sure.
It went horribly wrong. I personally don't think this lady could foresee what, you know, ultimately unfolded, but be that as it may, I regret that.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I do regret is placing faith in the Sekhukhune panel. I'd already by then been subjected to a panel which didn't hear me, didn't afford me a right of reply, and despite that, found that the allegations against me were baseless.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ivan Pillay convinced me to subject myself to a second panel. I regret doing that because, you know, I was dead against it. I was opposed against the having to be subjected to that process again. And I think that process was ultimately manipulated to sort a particular outcome. The third thing I regret is more in the general sense. And that is that, you know, we're a young democracy and we need all the little bits that make us a good nation. And here you had a unit of, from 2010 until 2014, six people.
Mm.
And boy, those six people worked day and night and delivered. We don't have that anymore. It's gone. I regret that. You know, I regret that for the sake of our country and for our nation. Because it's almost as if the Revenue Service no longer sees itself as a pinnacle player in the fight against crime and economic stability and safety. It's almost as if they've taken a step back.
Mm.
And I deeply regret that. It's tragic for me. How are we going to fix that, you know? How long will it take to get back there again? Adrian's mentioned 55 people. Those are managers. I know of people who were the grafters. These were the guys who slept on stretchers in the office, who worked through the night. They were the transfer pricing specialists, the income tax specialists. They've also left. You know, we just don't hear about them because they're not known people.
Mm.
And they're out in the private sector now, and they're probably working for the opposition.
Yeah, finding ways of avoiding unnecessary taxes.
And that's tragic for me. That's really very, very sad.
Have there been a lot of instances of people being taken advantage of because they simply didn't know that they were being taken advantage of? And by the time they discover that, it's too late because now they're embroiled in criminal activity. You know, I always joke when I ask for somebody's signature to a lease agreement that I'm signing, and I always joke and say, haha, you've just signed your soul away. But is it very easy for people who don't know to be taken advantage of by criminals who are trying to hide and move money?
Especially inside SARS.
Yeah, look, it happens. You know, there are always con artists. Mm-hmm. No matter where you go in the world, there are con artists.
One of the biggest scams that we came across regularly was some kind of bookkeeper, tax advisor, promising you a refund. So let me do your tax return, and I will guarantee you, you know, for a small fee. So you pay me 600 Rand, I'll get you a 6,000 Rand refund.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. Mm. And then what the taxpayer maybe unknowingly does is give away your ID number, give away your physical address, your cell number, your bank account details.
Yep.
Then it's game over for you.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, when SARS confronts you as individual, when you sign that tax declaration form, it's a legally binding thing that you submit to SARS. So you are liable for whatever it contains, regardless of whether someone does it on your behalf. But that was the most common scam that we found, is the promise for a tax refund.
Gentlemen, we only have a few minutes left. I just want to know what you think the best case scenario outcome from all of this might be, and what you think the worst scenario might be in terms of where we're at with the finance minister, with SARS, with the rogue unit and all the noise around that, your book, how you would like to see things develop, best case and worst case.
Well, this will be an interesting week, and I think a very telling week for the future of our country and our economy. I'll be out in the streets on the 2nd.
You are? You're joining the march?
and if I can get to court, I will be at court to support the Minister of Finance. Apart from that, I have my own legal issues that will play itself out before the High Court as well this week.
Yes, there's good luck.
There's a defamation suit against me. Best scenario.
Who brought that suit?
That is Mr. Moyani and SARS. With your tax money,
they're defending their own reputations.
Me. They are suing me for 12 million rand defamation claim, which I must defend. Best case scenario, if the charges can be dropped against the minister, Mr. Ivan Pillay, Opa Magashula, if they can be continued to go on with their lives and the work that especially the minister has to do in this time. We know there's a review by ratings agencies that towards the end of the year. So important work must be done to instill investor confidence, especially international investors, in the prospects of our economy and our growth potential.
Mm-hmm.
Worst case scenario, these criminal charges continue, they mutate, they drag out. I don't know what the consequences politically will be for our country, but it will not be good. I cannot see it that there will be a good outcome if things continue as they are today.
Yeah, look, I would say best case scenario is sanity. I think, please, we really need to just chill for a moment. Stop, assess, make the right decisions, no matter how difficult they are. I would really want, in a best case scenario, to see our Directorate of Priority Crimes Investigations Department, the Hawks,
mm-hmm.
and our National Priority Crimes Litigation Unit of the National Prosecuting Authority to be doing what their mandates say. Focus on priority crimes. There are lists. I mean, I can just start, you know. Every Saturday, every Sunday, there's a new story.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not millions, it's billions.
Right.
Focus on that. Stick to your mandate. Give us hope in the law enforcement capacity again.
And stop these mad witch hunts.
Yeah, I mean, this is just. I don't see. Let us for a moment assume that Gordon Pillay and Magashula are guilty.
Mm.
Okay. Why use the Crimes Against the State, the DPCI, and the National Priority Crimes Litigation? You know, that's like.
It's like chopping down a tree with a penknife, or the opposite.
It's the opposite. It's with a scalpel.
Yeah, it's taking a matchstick to pieces with an axe.
Correct. Yeah. So, you know, sanity, stop, everybody. You know, these are all comrades. These are people who, the majority of them, fought in the trenches for freedom
mm-hmm.
that we now have in this country, political freedom at least. They know each other. They know of each other. They have so much in common. So find each other again. You know, don't fight with each other in this way. Not in this blatant, open way. Because it doesn't make us as South Africans feel, you know, proud of our nation to see 101 ANC stalwarts issue a letter.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a good sign. Worst case scenario is that they push ahead with us, and they will be embarrassed in court. I mean, I know. I was a law enforcement official for the bulk of my adult life. I served this country. I've testified in courts. I've built cases. I can tell you, the case against Mr. Gordon is dead. There is no case. But if they push ahead, it's a bad sign for what's ahead for us.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. Thank you for writing this book. Thank you for putting yourselves out there, because we know it's a dangerous and fraught place to be, and it's a terrific read. I suggest everybody, for Christmas, Mavs, get yourself a copy of this book and see how it all really works. And thank you for writing it. It couldn't have been an easy process to put yourselves out there. And good luck to you both. I hope that these ridiculous criminal charges are dropped, and that you can carry on with your lives, and that you can start to have some semblance of sanity in your own lives as well.
This is CliffCentral.com.